Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
If you came this way, taking any route, starting from anywhere, at any time or at any season, it would always be the same. You would have to put off sense and notion. You are not here to verify, instruct yourself, or inform curiosity or carry report. You are here to kneel where prayer has been valid. That was T.S. Eliot in Little Gidding, the last of the four quartets. And Little Gidding is a very beautiful, tiny little church, very hard to find, that was the final point in my recent exciting tour of Middle England, which Dominic has laughed at me about. But it was
laughing now.
It was a wonderful, wonderful place, and a reminder that, in a sense, churches are among our most kind of intimate way to get in touch with history. Eliot, again, in Little Gidding, Eliot famously said that history is a pattern of timeless moments, and you kind of can really feel that, I think, in churches. Or am I being overly romantic, Dominic?
No, I don't think you are at all. I think certainly, to bring out my inner John Bull, which is never much suppressed, I think England's wealth of parish churches is the envy of any country in the world. I mean, these fantastic historical sites, whereas you say the sort of the layers of the past just seem to kind of strip away as you walk inside the church, and you know you're standing where generations of people stood. You're looking at what, you know, endless generations have looked at, and a place that they took immensely seriously. That kind of, even now, you don't have to be a believer to feel that these places are kind of weighed down with the solemnity and the seriousness of the sort of faith of ages.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the coming of Christianity and then the Reformation, and then I suppose the process of de-Christianization are such profound influences on English, British, Irish history that I think that an episode devoted to what churches can tell us about the past is more than justified. And I just want to put it on record, because there has been suggestion on Twitter that the fact that you've had COVID this past week and have been
I have it as we speak. I've risen from my sick bed to do this.
Wow. I mean, this is like a kind of something from the Bible in itself.
It is.
But people have suggested that I have snuck this in while you've been but actually, Dominic, this is your idea, isn't it?
Yes, it pains me to admit it, but it is my idea. Because, Tom, I happen to know the absolute best person in the entire British Isles
You can't say British Isles.
I just did.
The Atlantic Archipelago, I believe.
The entire British Isles to talk about churches. She's an Irish woman. Her name is Rachel Morley. She's a former winner of Person of the Year at her old school. She's the director of the Friends of Friendless Churches. And most of all, her big claim to fame, she is my sister-in-law, and here she is. Hello, Rachel.
Hello.
Morning, Rachel.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for that, Dominic.
You're very welcome. You were Person of the Year.
I was.
Don't be embarrassed about it.
No, I'm not embarrassed. I was Person of the Year, but I find it very strange that you suggested this topic, because any time when I come to visit and I talk about churches, or I bring them up, you always just kind of put your head in your hands and say, not another bloody church.
There's a lot of rolling of eyes goes on in my house.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm surprised. I'm as surprised as anybody to be here today. So
Rachel actually wants to live with us, Tom. She lived with us for 18 months?
No, only about 10.
It felt like 18.
Did you take Dominic around lots of churches? I hope so.
I did not, no.
Oh, missed opportunity.
He wouldn't come with me. There's no point.
What can you do with this man?
I know.
No, but this is ridiculous because Dominic has suggested this subject. So yeah. Dominic, I mean, this is a great theme. So how are we going to do this? Rachel, you have chosen your... I mean, we said 10 best. Best mm-hmm. is, I mean, it's a hopeless phrase.
10
I
top
mean,
churches. I mean,
and we put... So I put a request for kind of people's suggestions on Twitter. And I don't think we've ever had quite the response that we had to that. I mean, we had more people reply to that than I think anything we've put out before. An immense range of suggestions. Dominic, we had... What did we have? We had... some entirely predictable ones from people who've appeared on the show. So Dan Jackson, author of Northumbrians, obviously went for
a Northern Church, St. George's.
Yes, they're all Northumbrian ones. Jonathan Wilson, son of Sunderland, he went for St. Peter's Church, Monk Wearmouth, which is of course a brilliant choice. That's the one that famous for Bede. The glory of the Northeast. What else did we have? We had so Rachel. We had a lot of enthusiasm for Durham Cathedral. We had Simon Sharma.
Yeah, he chose historian. Magnus Cathedral Kirkwall. Do you agree with that choice, Rach?
I do not. No. Well, okay. Okay, the reason why is because you asked for churches and so many people gave you cathedrals. I mean, that's...
Right, a rookie's error.
Well, it's not what you asked for, so why would they be telling you cathedrals?
Simon Sharma didn't even read the question.
He didn't even read the question, exactly. So there we go. And I guess the thing is, I'm really nervous because this is a massive responsibility, okay? And it's been done so many times before. Like, obviously, Betjeman did his best British churches...
Right. Yes. And on that. Yes. Yeah, so on that. So we also had one from Giles Fraser, famous vicar. Top vicar. And he suggested St. Enadoc.
Top 10 vicars. Yeah.
Yeah. St. Enadoc in North Cornwall, which is a wonderful church, has a spire that looks like the tail of a stegosaur, and it's. But also, it's where John Betjeman is buried. And John Betjeman. He loved his churches, didn't he?
Rachel has been to St. Enadoc Church with me.
I have.
Oh, so you have been to a church, Dominic?
I have. Yeah, it's a great church. It used to be used to be covered by sand dunes, didn't it, Rach?
It did, yeah, exactly. And the vicar...
And it's got a golf course all around it.
It does.
The vicar used to have to climb down through a ladder, didn't he, in the roof?
In the spire, yeah.
In the spire.
Because it was just poking out through the sand, yeah.
So, Rachel, does that qualify St. Enadoc as one of the top churches?
It's a great church. It's not on my list.
Oh, okay. Okay, so what are the qualifications you brought for your choice of the top 10? And we're including Ireland as well as Britain.
Well, we'll see about that. Let's just say, okay, so Betjeman has done it. He did 1,000 best churches. There's Alec Clifton Taylor. There's Pevsner. They're kind of like the giants of 20th century talking about churches.
And Simon Jenkins.
Oh, yeah, and Simon Jenkins. But he sort of just ripped off Betjeman doing his 1,000 best church. Well, he did.
Hard-hitting opinion on churches here. We've got
also, them. And also, he didn't even go to all of the churches, and some that are on my list aren't in his 1,000 best churches, which I think is just, you know, terrible that he... But also, I think there's a book that's the nation's favourite churches, but again, loads of people voted for cathedrals on that, which I just don't understand. I mean, there are like 16,000 churches in England alone. You have loads of choice. You don't have to go for the obvious cathedrals. Anyway, and then there's Jay Hume on Twitter. And last year he did a World Cup of major churches, which was hugely popular. And the final two, I think, were St. Wolfram's in Grantham in Lincolnshire and Tewkesbury Abbey. And in the end, St. Wolfram's in Grantham, home of Isaac Newton and, well, not home, but he went to school there, and Margaret Thatcher, that one won. So that was very interesting. But basically, thinking about it, I was thinking, okay, so what do you go for the best? Do you go for the oldest, the biggest, the, you know, the finest interior, the one with the tallest spire, the longest nave, you know, the smallest,
If you're doing cathedrals, you want to go for the tallest spire.
Okay.
I think we can all agree that Salisbury is the best cathedral.
It's not as good as Lincoln. But it's not as good as Lincoln. Lincoln's a better cathedral.
Because Lincoln's fell down.
Go on, Rach.
Because it was
so great.
Don't
listen to Tom Holland.
Anyway, that's fine.
Just Talk over him.
And then, okay, great, I will. And then there are other things like, you know, you've got churches that are called like, you know, the Cathedral of the Marshes, the Queen of the Moors, all of these. And those are all kind of like great churches. But the thing is, whenever you do lists and compile things like this, it's always the same ones that come out. You always get the same ones. There's St. Peter's, Walpole, St. Peter's in Norfolk. There's St. Mary's, Redcliffe in Bristol. Roslyn Chapel, Fairford, Long Melford, Burford, you know. So there's no point in me going through all of those because everybody knows those. And, you know, there are so many churches to choose from. There are 42,000 places of worship, around 42,000 places of worship in the UK. So, you know, let's look for actually ones that are a bit more interesting and not obvious choices. So that's
brilliant.
Mine.
Okay.
Is that okay?
That's fantastic specification. So
nothing obvious, basically.
Okay, so your top 10 unobvious churches.
Yeah.
Are they in random order? Are you going from 10 to 1 or?
Well, they're sort of in random order. What I tried to do was try and make a nice story so that they all kind of flow into
good.
One and the
well,
other.
Oh, we like a story.
Oh, we do like a story.
Great. So, yeah.
Okay. Grand. So what are you kicking off with?
Okay. I'm kicking off with one which is one that I really like, obviously, because it's in my top 10. But I used to live near St. Mary the Virgin in Shrewsbury. And I absolutely love Shrewsbury. Dominic knows it's my favourite place in the whole of England. And St. Mary Shrewsbury is a great church. You know, the river sort of carves out Shrewsbury. The river defines Shrewsbury. And the town sort of rises up from there. And St. Mary's is kind of at the top of that. And it's a gorgeous old red sandstone church. It's got a great big spire. That's all lovely. The reason why I'm bringing it in, first of all, is that it's got a really... not just about the architecture, but it's got a really interesting story around it. Dominic, I don't know if you know this. You're a Shropshire native, aren't you?
I don't know this. I am a Shropshire native.
Grand.
I blank out all church stuff because I leave that to you.
Okay, thanks. So anyway, it's all about... the story is all about Robert Cadman. And he was an 18th century steeplejack and rope slider. And he used to perform all of these sorts of tricks. And he was from Shrewsbury, which is lovely. And he travelled kind of all around the country. So he was in Dorset and Lincolnshire. And newspapers kind of say these great feats of daring that this guy used to do. And he... One of his kind of big tricks was he would climb up the front of St. Mary's, which is, you know, bits of a Norman church in there. So it's a really ancient church. So he'd climb up the front of it. It was 250 metres up the church. Then a 68 metre spire up to the top. He'd have a rope going from the top of the spire down and anchored into a meadow across the other side of the river. So as he's going up, he's doing all kinds of sorts of, you know, tricks and making the crowd laugh and everyone's having a great jolly time. Anyway, he gets to the top and then he puts on a wooden breastplate and there's a big groove down the centre of it. And he hurls himself onto this rope and he's meant to slide all the way from the top of the spire, over the river, over the meadows and kind of land, you know, perfectly standing on the other side in one piece, preferably. He did that several times. That was fine. Yeah. Except once, which was kind of the end of it, the last time he did it, which was 1739 when the rope actually snapped and he fell and he died. So that's very sad. But there's a plaque on the outside of the church, so right by the main door as you go in. So it's like it's a big event in the church's history, right? So yeah. There's a plaque outside and it reads, "Let this small monument record the name of Cadman and to the future time proclaim how by an attempt to fly from this spire across the Sabrina stream he did acquire his fatal end. 'Twas not for want of skill or courage to perform the task he fell, but no, a faulty cord being drawn too tight hurried his soul on her high to take her flight, which bid the body here beneath good night." So that's lovely.
So he was basically a failed tightrope walker.
No, but I mean, he had loads of success. He died when he was 28, but he had loads of success until then.
Right, live fast, die young.
But it's a really cool story. Anyway, but beyond that, the church is really interesting. So the actual building is great too. Go on, Tom.
I was just going to say, on the topic of kind of jumping off the top of churches, you've given Dominic a Shrewsbury one, a Shropshire one. There's a famous Wiltshire.
Go on, yeah.
Which is Aylmer of Malmesbury, the monk who built himself a glider and hurled himself off the top of Malmesbury. And... He crash landed and lost the use of his legs, but he didn't die.
Okay.
So I'm just sticking up for that. People who jump off churches in Wiltshire are slightly better at it than people who jump off it in Shropshire.
So I'd rather be killed. You might prefer to be killed outright, I think. It depends how.
No, because then you have a long, profitable life as a hero of aeronautics.
Well, a failed hero of aeronautics, surely.
No, the glider worked. Anyway, listen, we're getting off and I'm distracted from
top 10 gliders rather than top 10 churches.
Dominic, I kind of thought of you with this one. Obviously, there's a Shropshire connection, but also you recently did a nice go ape challenge, so you were doing your own bit of rope sliding. Do you think you were as good as Cadman?
Dominic, tell us about this. I didn't know anything about this.
We went in the summer. We went and did Go Ape with my son and two of his friends. Now, the two friends had difficulties completing the course, so that left me and Arthur. And I found it absolutely terrifying. So Go Ape, for people who don't know, is this thing where you've got kind of platforms and walkways and kind of adventure playground type things suspended high in trees. It's for sort of daredevil type activity. And I kind of
Does Dominic strike you as a daredevil?
An intellectual daredevil, surely.
I'm loving this insight into how Dominic is seen.
I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was so terrified. There was a thing where you had to do a climbing wall suspended between two trees, and it was a way of getting from tree to tree.
So jumping off churches wouldn't be your bag.
I don't think it would. There's a lot of zip wires involved in Go Ape. So, I mean, that's basically what was going on in Shrewsbury, isn't it?
Exactly.
Great choice, okay. Rachel.
But anyway, just to say a couple of more things about that church, because it is gorgeous. So it's, it's like lots of lovely Norman bits, lovely old red sandstone. But when you go in, it's got an amazing 15th century roof, carved timber roof in the nave. But I think probably the real kind of crowning glory of the church is the stained glass. So it's got an almost complete Jesse window in the east window from about 1330. It did come from the old St. Chad's in Shrewsbury, which collapsed, unfortunately. But they've got that stained glass, but also in all of the other windows, or most of the other windows, it's got some of the best collection of 15th and 16th century continental stained glass. I mean, it's amazing. You could spend hours looking at stained glass there. It's just gorgeous. But also, if you're in Shrewsbury, you can also go to St. Alkmund's, St. Chad's, the Abbey. You can go to the Old Market Hall. And
are you being paid by the Shrewsbury Tourist Board?
I would like to work for Shropshire Tourism.
And Rachel, can I just ask you, just very quickly, often when you go to churches, you'll be told, oh, the stained glass window got destroyed in the Reformation, or it got destroyed, but shot by Cromwell's troopers or whatever.
Yeah.
How true is that? Do you know? I mean, is it a...
I imagine some of them were, yeah.
But by and large, the idea that all stained glass window got smashed in the Reformation
I guess two things. It depended on what it depicted and how obvious it was, I suppose, you know?
Yeah.
I guess some of it was. I don't know. I don't think all of it was. I mean, definitely all of it wasn't.
No, obviously not. If it's there,
yeah,
there's
obviously
some
not.
Great survivals. Yeah.
Presumably the more figurative, but also the more obviously sort of papist it was.
Yeah.
The more likely it was to be destroyed. It must be as simple as that, surely. And just whether the church was occupied at some point by soldiers.
Yeah.
Like Burford, let's say.
Yeah.
Like soldiers were in the church.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, well, Rach, we're going far too slowly.
I know, okay, I'm good. And this is a big one. That was meant to be my short one, so we need to hurry up. From there, my kind of seamless segue into the next one is, great feats of daring, you know, brilliant people. So there I go to North Wales, to St. Beinel, Clinog Fair in Gwynedd. Do you know this one, Tom?
No.
Okay, great. Dominic, I know you don't know, so there's no point asking you. I know you don't. Anyway, so St. Beinel was probably one of the most important saints in Wales, definitely in North Wales. His name, it's kind of a mutation of Old Welsh, and it means knowing cattle. So
brilliant.
Even to the...
Yeah. That's not a name you want.
But also, well. To this day, he's still the patron saint of sick cattle and children. So there we go. So anyway, from that you might think that Beinel had a came from an agricultural background, but he didn't actually. He was a grandson of a king of Powys in the 7th century, and ultimately he chose the monastery over the monarchy. He packed off to Bangor and he became an abbot. He was a missionary, he travelled around a lot, that's all great. There's 11 churches in total dedicated to him. One is the smallest, one of the smallest, St. Beino's Colbourne in Somerset, which is very nice. But the one I want to talk about is St. Beino's Clonfert. And that's on the Clyn Peninsula. And it is a 15th century whopper. Like, it's just, it's gorgeous. It's huge, it's massive. Big, massive space. It's got this gorgeous, it's plain glazing, no stained glass in the east window. But it's got, you know, screen, misery cord. It's got lovely crocketed, sorry Dominic, you won't like me using technical terms. I know I was warned off using terms that people wouldn't know. But anyway, crocketed sedilia, all of that sort of stuff. It's great. But this church was the site of this the monastery, St. Beino's Monastery. So it's really interesting. Beino was buried here. He was interred in the monastery chapel. But the monastery and the chapel were both destroyed by Vikings in the 10th century.
And coming from Ireland, presumably. Were they? Why would Vikings be attacking North Wales? Were they coming from Dublin or something?
Maybe, yeah.
You don't care.
I don't really care, because that's not on my story, and I have no time to talk about all this. Anyway, so there's loads to say. So anyway, what's interesting is across the road there's a holy well, with St. Beino's holy well, and apparently if you went on your pilgrimage, you could go to this holy well, you could be dunked into the water, and you would be cured of anything from epilepsy, rickets, and impotence. But to make it work, you had to go for a big dunking in the well, then go across the road to the church and sleep on top of Beino's grave, for the night. So that was great. And then that was all fine, and that was actually a practice that continued like until the 1700s.
But nobody does it now.
Nobody does it now, because rather than the Vikings, the Victorians came along and said that the tomb was unsafe, so they dismantled it.
Health and safety.
For health and safety, yeah. Victorian health and
goodness
safety.
Goodness sake.
But so Cadman's great gift, sort of, was sliding down ropes. Beino's great gift is bringing people back from the dead. So he did this lots of times. That was great. And it included his niece, Winifred. She chose to be a nun. Her jilted lover chopped off her head, which seems to be a occupational hazard if you were a saint in Wales, kind of back in the 7th, 8th century, 6th, 7th century. But St. Winifred's well in Flintshire is on the site where her head fell off, and apparently this spring came up. Mm-hmm. And it's actually it's one of the most popular places in Wales. Absolutely gorgeous. It's called the Lords of Wales. So that's great.
So do people still go there to get healed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
How many? Lots of people?
Loads of people, yeah. Anyway, just very, very quickly, because there's loads of great stories about Beino, but actually my favourite one is basically, he was really popular, everyone wanted a bit of him, you know, in his monastery and all this sort. So he needed a bit of time to pray, so what he used to do was he'd go out into the middle of a river, and he had a rock, and he'd kneel on the river to pray at night time. Anyway, one night he was disturbed, and he muttered something under his breath, and obviously he's got a direct line to God, so he said something like, you know, somebody should teach that person a lesson or something like that, something to those effect. And basically all of these wild animals came out of the woods and ripped this person to shreds. And anyway, Beino just continued praying, didn't notice, came back, and then he realised it was one of his pupils, a guy called Al Hearn, and he was, you know, Beino was in an awful way, but luckily he has this power of bringing people back from the dead. So basically he just went around and gathered all the bits of him and put him back together, and he was fine. But he couldn't find his eyebrow. Beino couldn't find one of his eyebrows. It was missing. So what he did was he looked around and he said, oh, okay. So he had his staff that he used to help get him out of the river, and they had an iron tip. So he took the iron tip off his staff, stuck it onto Al Hearn's forehead, and gave him his other eyebrow. And from then on, this Saint Al Hearn, he became a saint, was known as Iron Eyebrow.
Brilliant. So he's not the patron saint of plastic surgeons.
No, just sick cattle. So, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I think that's a great one as well.
That's a very good one.
Okay. Right.
And I mean, the whole thing, people worrying about, you know, churches are worried that people aren't going to church. I mean, the option of being brought back to life, I mean, that would be incentive.
But I mean, surely the option of being brought back to life is a key part of the Christian
yeah,
faith, isn't
exactly.
it, Tom?
Oh, Dominic, stop it with your theological jokes. Okay, so
on,
that's
Rachel.
Brilliant. So that's two.
All
so,
right.
So
ooh,
number
gosh,
three.
Okay, three. Big one. We're staying in North Wales. This time we're going to St. Brothin's, Llanfrothin in North Wales. This is
Saint
one.
Say that again. Sorry.
Saint Brothin, Llanfrothin.
Okay.
That's fine.
Just checking.
That's fine. Did you think you might know it, Dominic? I did.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
That one.
So this is a great church. This is one that I actually look after with Friend of the Friendless Churches. But this is a church where there's one man, and he basically changed the course of history after his death at this church. So do either of you know a guy called Robert Roberts?
No.
Right, okay. I didn't think you did. He was a North Walian quarryman in 1888.
You're him. That one.
You're historians, come on. So anyway, Robert Roberts died 1888, and he wanted to be buried next to his daughter. That was his one wish. But he wasn't a member of the established Church of England. Dun, dun, dun. He was a nonconformist. And that's where all the trouble began. There's loads of kind of story about why this didn't work out for him. But basically, the vicar wouldn't allow him to be buried in the church next to his daughter, in the churchyard next to his daughter. And the scene was sort of set for a clash. So how it all happens was Robert Roberts' family went to a newly qualified solicitor, a guy ye will know, definitely. You'll know this guy if you don't know Robert Roberts. David Lloyd George, have you heard of him?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Dominic's hero. Dominic loves David Lloyd George.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, it sounds like I've sort of picked Dominic's best churches. Anyway.
That's all right. That's how it should be.
That was unintentional, but I thought I'd get this in. So basically, this burial is sort of what launched David Lloyd George's career. So basically, he was a newly qualified solicitor. He was aged 25, and he took up this case, and he advised the family to just go ahead, defy the vicar, defy the diocese, and bury Robert Roberts next to his daughter in the Church of Wales churchyard. But the vicar knew this was kind of brewing, so he locked up the churchyard and all of this, and so they couldn't get in. But what they did do, led by David Lloyd George, they went to this really remote church down all of these winding lanes. They brought the body down there. David Lloyd George broke open the churchyard gates, and by candlelight and lanterns, they buried Robert Roberts next to his daughter. All lovely, until the vicar found out. Then there was a huge court case. The jury voted in favour of the Roberts family. The judge voted in favour of the church. Not voted, you know what I mean. David Lloyd George appealed it at the High Court and eventually won. But that basically launched his career, because then 2 years later he was voted the MP for Carnarvon Shire, and then he became, you know, the rest is history, as you might say.
Goodness.
Nicely done. Very nicely done.
Has anyone ever done that before?
They haven't, actually.
No, you're the first.
Okay.
Can I just ask, the daughter, how long had she been dead? Do we know? Was it a kind of mouldering body, or...?
It was a mouldering body, yeah. Definitely. Definitely, yeah. Yeah.
So this is basically a battle between dissenters, Welsh dissenters, and the established church, which was a huge political issue, actually, in the late 20th century.
Well,
completely forgotten now.
Well, exactly, but also all of this stuff... So, you know, David Lloyd George did... I mean, Lloyd George, I can probably just call him that. I don't need to give him his full name. But this case became sort of the catalyst for the establishment of the church in Wales as well, which which eventually happened in the 1920s. So all of that sort of happened because of this burial case, which is really cool. But just really quickly, the church is amazing too. So Saint Brothin was a 6th century saint. The church is now 13th century. It's built on right on the estuary. So right on the shore, it's amazing 15th century roof, massive timbers, absolutely gorgeous. Definitely go and see it.
Okay, well, so a landmark in the history of disestablishmentarianism.
Yeah, exactly.
Well done, Tom.
Which is definitely a word we've never had on the podcast before.
And before we move from that area,
yeah,
I just have
the fourth one.
You got the fourth.
No. This is just kind of a little, you know,
a cheat.
This is 3A. So if you really like your prime ministers, which, you know, I know some of the listeners to this show should you should go and see St. Deniol's in Hawarden in Flintshire, which is where Gladstone was married in 1839. Do you know this, Dominic? You're nodding.
Yeah, Gladstone Hoveden. Yeah, of course.
Fine, grand. But apparently when they got married, the church was crammed to suffocation with females, which, you know, some people might like. anyway, what's really interesting about this, there's obviously that history, but there's a memorial chapel to Gladstone, and the family commissioned Gladstone's very good friend, Burne Jones, to design the window. And it's an absolute... I mean, Burne Jones is great, if you like him. Some people don't. but it's an amazing window. It's a nativity scene. You know, it's massive, all beautiful, kind of usual Burne Jones style. But yeah, definitely worth going to see if you like prime ministers and Burne Jones.
Wow, we do.
Yeah, great. We love it.
Yeah, on this podcast, we love Burne Jones, we love prime ministers. So that's absolutely ticking every box.
Great.
And Rachel, we've been talking for half an hour, so I think we should have a break.
Really?
And you've done three.
I know.
So you've got to get seven in. So there's now huge jeopardy.
Yeah.
Will you be able to get your now seven into half an hour?
I mean,
guys, yeah. Don't go away.
Yeah.
I'm not allowed to say that, am I, Dominic? Because it sounds appealing. But I mean, this is so exciting.
Well, no one would want to go away because it is so exciting. Can you get seven into
Can you get seven
half
into half an hour?
Definitely.
Come back
not.
In a minute. Find out. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are facing a half an hour of intense excitement and jeopardy as our guest, Rachel Morley, the director of Friends of Friends Churches, former winner of Person of the Year, is going to see if she can fit her remaining seven churches into the last half hour of the show, having taken the first half hour to do three churches. So, Rachel,
it's massive, isn't it? It's high octane church.
I mean, this is unbelievable drama.
At its best.
Okay, so neither of you talk for the next half an hour, please. Okay, so, and I'll just get it out. Fine. Okay, next. Number four on my list. I have a big intro to this because I want to try and fit as many churches in as possible, so I'm just going to try my best, okay? Right, anyway. Whew. Who knows about the Commonwealth Graves Commission?
Yeah, I do. I've been to it.
Actually. Well done. Anyway, okay. Yeah. There's a really good book that came out, I think, last year or the year before called Tomb with a View by Peter Ross. He's got a great chapter in it. And he taught me lots about the Commonwealth Graves Commission that I didn't realise. So things like, if you're buried in a Commonwealth grave cemetery, your stone has to be 813 millimetres above the grass. And the grass has to be cut between 3.5 and 6 centimetres. I thought that was very interesting. Anyway, this is kind of a segue into number four, which is World War Churches, Chapels, Memorial Churches, Chapels. So I want to call out just two, which will be very familiar, and I'm not going to have time to talk about them in any great depth, despite I've written loads. There's the Italian Chapel in Orkney, which is great. It's a prisoner of war double Nissen huts. They used cement. They used things like corned beef tins to make candle holders and car exhaust to make the font. Really great.
Rach, let me interrupt. Yes. One of our listeners suggested this.
Kimru
Fod. He suggested it.
Well, so, that's Kimru, great.
Give yourself a massive round of applause.
Yes.
Great. Anyway, moving on from that, there's a Wales place of war. There's a Wales prisoner of war chapel, which many people don't know about. It's Henllyn Chapel near the River Tyvee. That was a 1994 chapel. Again, 1944 chapel. It's a Nissen hut, and they used all sorts of things like berries, tea, coffee. They burned fish or boiled fish bones to make glue, and they decorated. That's all great. I have to go at really high speed. So, number four.
Neither of those was number four.
No,
unbelievably.
No, no. Those were just ones that deserve a mention. They deserve a mention, but they're not number four. So number four is probably one of the most moving places I've ever been in my whole entire life. It's the Sandon Memorial Chapel in Hampshire. It is, outside it's a really modest kind of red brick chapel, but inside it is just, it's just this epic large-scale murals. The interior is entirely painted by Stanley Spencer, and it was done between 1920 and 1926, and it was built to honour the forgotten dead of World War One, specifically Lieutenant Harry Sandon, who basically he was on the Salonika front with Spencer. He came back from the war, but he caught malaria, they think, while he was out there, and he died once he came back, but he doesn't appear on any official kind of list or anything because he wasn't kind of, you know, one of the official warden. Exactly. Great. Thanks, Dominic. Anyway, what's great about this is, so it's scenes from, so Stanley Spencer, he worked as an orderly in Beaufort Hospital in Bristol, and then he was out on the Salonika front, and basically there are a series of paintings, so it shows his time in the hospital, working in the hospital, so it's like filling tea urns, changing the beds, doing the laundry, all of that sort of thing. And then above you've got scenes from Salonika, and it's so moving. He painted himself into it, so he's, you know, he's cooking rashers. There's a dog licking out an empty Fray Bentos tin. It's just so powerful because of the scale that they're on. And then I have to miss out so much because I have no time. But anyway, the east wall is this resurrection scene, and it's not like any other resurrection scene you will ever see. It's basically in the centre there's a carriage, and it's broken apart, it's split apart, there's bits of wood flying everywhere, there are two horses which have collapsed right in the middle, and it's just a chaotic scene right in the foreground, and it's all of these men who are getting out of their graves, and they're picking up their white crosses, and they're walking towards a figure barely decipherable in the kind of background, and it's a little white figure of Christ. He's tiny, and they're walking up and they're giving their crosses to Christ, and after that they walk past him into kind of a peaceful landscape, which is Watership Down, which is near where the chapel is located.
Watership as Down,
as in rabbits,
yeah, but also it's a place, it's a real place. So anyway, so that's absolutely amazing. But what was really terrible about this was, when they came to consecrate the chapel, all the various bishops said they wouldn't consecrate it because it showed animals being resurrected. So the horses were kind of, you know, coming back to life, and the dogs and stuff like that. And they said, animals don't have souls, so we're not going to resurrect it. Eventually, the Bishop of Guildford said he would consecrate the chapel, but only if they put curtains and stuff over the animals, because they...
My God, that's very harsh.
Isn't it bonkers? Anyway, that is one of the most... I haven't done it justice.
Animals definitely have souls.
And Rachel, Spencer did this before Cookham and all that?
Yes. So Cookham is, what he called, like, a little suburb of heaven. So, yeah, so that's his...
There's all that kind of amazing stuff, again, all of people coming out of the graves and things.
Exactly. No, it's one of the... it's just one of those... And, sorry, I will just say, there's one scene in it where... It's in the hospital, and they're meant to be disinfecting the bedside lockers. So it's they've got these copper baths, and there's a man kind of, you know, putting them into the thing. But Stanley Spencer was really small. He was like 5'2" and weighed less than 7 stone. And he couldn't actually physically lift the lockers into the baths to do the work. and he paints himself into it, and he's crouching, he's hiding between the two baths, trying to kind of get away from it all. And it's just, oh, sorry, I have goosebumps thinking about it. More people should know about it. It's so wonderful.
Well, thank you. That sounds amazing.
All right, number five.
Okay, this is a very quick one. This was meant to be my number five and my breaking point because I wanted to sing a little song at the end of it.
You can't miss out on the song.
Just very, very quickly. So number five is St. Nicholas's Worth in Sussex. So this is a... it was once in a clearing of a forest. It's the largest Saxon cruciform church that still survives on its original foundations. The forest is now cleared and the church is sort of squeezed between the M23 and a housing estate in Crawley. But it is one of, like, I know Dominic, you're making faces, but it is actually like one of the most important and ancient churches. Somebody once described it as the most beautiful set of arches left to us by the Saxon world, which is great.
Sounds good.
Yeah, anyway. Interesting things about this is all the Saxon stuff, obviously, but in the churchyard you will find Robert Whitehead, who, does anybody know who he was?
No.
Tom.
Fine. No. He was the inventor of the torpedo.
Oh, that's a good fact.
It is a good fact, and basically he sold his first torpedoes to the Austrians, and then in 1912 his granddaughter went to, not launch torpedoes, that would be terrible, to celebrate a new torpedo or something in Austria. And she met...
As you do.
She met the commander, who was George von Trapp, and she went on to marry him. They had seven children in 12 years. Then she died, and the husband moved to Salzburg, needed a nanny, got a nun called Maria, and then they became the von Trapp family choir, and there's the Sound of Music.
That is a very, very good story.
It is a good story.
I can see why you need a song.
Well, no, I'm not going to sing The Sound of Music, but basically, there's so much Saxon stuff about this. So it's Saxon arches, Saxon foundation, Saxon apse, Saxon windows. I don't know if this is right, but I like to make up songs. Dominic will know. This is sort of a thing in our family. We like to make up random songs about things.
I'm always making up songs, Tom.
So if I could give St. Nicholas Worth a song, I would call it... Sorry, I feel so embarrassed now, but anyway... I'm too Saxon for my shirt. Too Saxon for my shirt. So Saxon, it hurts. Anyway, there we go.
We've never had that singing on the podcast about the Anglo-Saxons before. But I think we should make it a rule.
Anyway, there we go. We have to move on. Sorry, guys.
Is that the only song?
That's the only song.
Oh,
sorry.
Disappointing. Oh.
Sorry. I mean, who knows? I might come up against anything else.
Spontaneously.
Anyway, the next one is Time and Space Church. Dominic, I know you like this. Sorry, Tom, you might like this too. I feel like I'm kind of leaving you out. Sorry. Anyway.
No, you focus on Dominic. He needs education.
He does need education, yes. Anyway, so Dominic, I know you did a series or a programme on sci-fi, didn't you?
A series, Rach.
A whole series. Oh, I thought it was just one-off. Oh, well, there we go. It's a great, great series if anybody would like to watch it.
Tomorrow's Worlds.
Tomorrow's Worlds.
The unearthly history of science fiction. Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know if you mentioned this because I don't actually remember if I watched the programme. But first of all, I want to go to St. John the Baptist Whitbourne in Herefordshire.
Weirdly, we didn't mention that in our science fiction series.
Well, Dominic, that is a huge oversight on your part because in the end of the 17th century, that is when Francis Goodwin, the Bishop of Herefordshire, he was living next to the church and he wrote the world's first science fiction novel, The Man on the Moon. The Man in the Moon. You didn't know that?
Get the title right.
The Man in the Moon. The Man in the Moon. Anyway, basically, very quickly, it's a Spanish man called Domingo Gonzalez. He's stranded on an island and he trains a flock of swans to basically fly him away in a cart, and they fly him up to the moon. And when he gets to the moon, or when he's on his way to the moon, he realises that actually Copernicus was right, that the Earth is not the centre of the universe and it revolves around the sun.
And when did he write this?
At the end of the 17th century.
Right.
Very, very end of the 17th century. And he also describes gravity, which is decades before Isaac Newton would ever go on to discover it. Godwin's buried in the churchyard in Whitburn. That's not the church. This is, again, just a segue.
Oh, God. That's not even the church.
It's not the church. Anyway.
There's so little time.
No, I know.
You keep doing these segues.
So little time, but so many churches. Anyway. Then, so we talked about Isaac Newton. From there, we go to St. Peter's and Paul Market Overton in Rutland. Basically, Isaac Newton's mother was from there. He spent a lot of time there. The church at Market Overton has lots of lovely Saxon elements. And in the churchyard, they discovered a bronze Saxon water clock, something that was kind of developed or derived from the ancient Egyptians. Newton was fascinated by this, and it kind of spurred on his studies and experiments into time and space. And apparently, there's a sundial on the church, and he donated it to the church in kind of gratitude for it kind of spurring on his studies. Anyway, the church that I want to talk about, which is actually number six, is...
Neither of those were the church.
No.
Unbelievable.
No. Anyway, but there's so many good churches. But basically, it's St. Gregory's Kirkdale in Yorkshire. I think somebody definitely mentioned this on your list. I'm pretty certain. So above that church, you will find a preserved Saxon sundial.
Oh, yes. Yes, you know that's wonderful.
That is a good one. Great. I'm glad you know it.
Yes. And it's next to where William Buckland found the hyena.
That's correct.
Bones
oh,
in the
Tom.
Cave.
Tom, yes. You're ruining my ending.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry,
fine.
Rachel. Sorry.
It's fine. It's
no,
fine.
But I love that church.
Okay, that's good. But you know that there's it's got like the longest inscription in Saxon English on that sundial. Do you know it? Do you know what it says?
I can't remember, but I do remember knowing
he
that.
Doesn't remember.
Okay, great. So I'll read it out to you very quickly. So it says, Orm, the son of Gamel, bought St. Gregory's church when it was utterly broke and fallen and caused to be made anew from the ground. He dedicated to Christ and St. Gregory in the days of King Edward and the days of Earl Trusty. Haworth bought me and Harith wrought me and brand the prior. So from that you can date the sundial to about 1055, 1065-ish, when Edward the Confessor was king, right? That's all great. Trusty is better known as Tostig, the brother of Harald.
The name of my cat.
Tom's got a cat.
The name of my cat.
Tostig.
Do you? Oh, great.
Yeah.
Lovely.
sorry. It all connects.
It all connects. But basically, then Tosti was killed. He killed the Gamal in that inscription, and then eventually he was himself killed at
Stamford Bridge.
Yeah. Basically. But the sundial is great. It's it was covered. It remains in such good condition because it was plastered over for about 700 years and was only discovered in 1771. But remarkably, it's actually... The sundial is a reused grave slab. So when Orm, son of Gamel, says in this inscription that the old church was broken down, they reused bits of that much earlier church, which 20th century excavations found to be about 8th or 9th century, which is really cool. So they found like carvings and stuff like that in the walls. And yeah, there's loads of lovely cross slabs and all of that sort of stuff in the walls, which is great. Anyway, that's right about Buckland. Quarryman, 1821, I think, yes, found nearby from there, reopened a cave, Stone Age things, hyena bones, but also hippopotamus bones. And yeah. It is, yeah, okay, Tom, you know what.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's such a kind of dramatic setting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go down from the church down and, yeah, it's fabulous. Yeah. Yes.
All right, let's crack on. What are you on now, number eight?
Number seven.
Oh, my God.
This is a quick one. Okay, This is weird animals to weird animals, sort of. So hippopotamuses to turkeys.
Great.
Okay. So most people think of churches, they think of Christmas. That's definitely what the Church of England stats will tell us anyway. But also there's a Yorkshire church that celebrates not only the coming of Christ, but also the coming of the turkey. Does anybody know what St. Andrew's Boynton in Yorkshire?
No,
I don't know.
Fine, okay. It's a gorgeous church, but there are turkeys everywhere in the church. And the reason is because William Strickland of Boynton, he brought the first turkey to Britain. So in 1526, he went to America to find his fortune. He went looking for gold, but came back with six turkeys. Basically, he bred them and then he sold them. And they became so popular, he became really rich. He was able to build a country house. He became an MP in the reign of Queen Elizabeth. But he adopted the turkey as his kind of family symbol. So there's a turkey lectern, there's turkeys in the window, there's turkeys all over the tombs. It's great. So first turkey came from him. And also, when he was trying to get his coat of arms, he used the turkey. And his little sketch of a turkey is the earliest depiction of a turkey in the whole of Europe.
That's fantastic.
What so, a claim to fame.
So why shouldn't turkeys be in churches?
Why shouldn't they be in churches?
You know, but they're God's creatures.
That's right, yeah. But also, as well as the turkeys, the church is absolutely gorgeous. Inside, it's like a Georgian box. Beautiful. Redesigned by John Carr of York in the 18th century. Green panelled pews. It's got clustered columns, cornice, plaster putty, swags, medallions. It's got this flourish of a staircase. Absolutely gorgeous. And my favourite is a really lovely Norman tub font, where it's got intersecting arches, kind of little, almost kind of classical capitals and plinths on the arches, and it's kind of got this greenish tinge, and it's absolutely lovely. Loads more to say about that, but we have no time.
Okay.
Great. So we've got two left.
We have three left.
Oh my three goodness. Left. Okay, I'm going to be really quick. I'll try.
No, the next... you've got 10 minutes.
Oh, okay. The next one is a long one. Okay. So this is kind of all
this
about
is
like...
so exciting for the listeners, finding out whether you're going to do it or not.
Okay. Let me just look at the time. Fine. 15 minutes. Okay, fine.
10.
All right, Tom, I get it. Fine. So the next thing is all about like superstitions and magic in churches. So first of all, I want to just give a mention to, this is not the church, by the way, I want to give a mention to St. Cadfan's in Gwynedd, which is, it's got a crying knight. It's a 1350s effigy. And basically, apparently the knight has been crying for about 650 years, but there's like water dripping out of his right eye all the time. This is my right eye. But somebody did some research, and actually it's a fault in the stone.
there's the very similar thing at Bartholomew the Great.
Oh, right, London, okay, yeah.
Where there was somebody who was crying, and then they fixed the drains and it stopped.
it's pretty much that sort of thing, which is sad. From there, a really popular church was St. Issue Patricio in Powys, where there's a kind of a rusty painted skeleton on the west wall. He's holding up a shovel and a hourglass, and people have tried and tried and tried to whitewash him out, but he keeps seeping back to the surface, so can't get rid of him. That's lovely. Then, kind of staying around that area, there's St. Michael's in Cascob, and there's an inscription on the wall, which I think is brilliant, where that kind of superstition and faith kind of the mixture is really good. So it's about 1700, and the inscription reads, "O Lord Jesus, we beseech thee for thy mercy, that this holy charm, abracadabra, may cure thy servant Elizabeth."
Does it really say abracadabra?
It says abracadabra, yep. "May cure thy servant Elizabeth Lloyd from all evil sprites and from all their diseases. Amen." So that's good. Wow. So, yeah. And then just very quickly to say that one such evil sprite could be Lilias Addy, who's in Scotland. So she was a witch who died in prison in Scotland in 1704. She's buried on the shore of Torrey Bay in Fife. And they put like a massive sandstone slab over her grave so that she couldn't get out, basically. And she was a witch because she confessed, probably under great torture, to having sex with the devil. So that was unfortunate. But basically, her body was dug up in the 19th century. Her skeleton was sold off, made into walking sticks, all of those sort of stuff.
What?
You know?
What? I'd happily have such a walking stick.
It's awful. It's awful. And now
that's
I think,
a terrible thing.
I know. And people, there's a group in Scotland that are trying to kind of get her.
Bring all the walking sticks back together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And bury her properly. Anyway, but just
put on them.
Well, so that lady, you know, admitted to having sex with the devil, that's fine. But in Shropshire there's Halston Hall, where there's a guy called Mad Jack Mighton. I don't know if anybody knows of him. No? Okay, great.
Yeah, I know him.
Great.
Yeah.
So, you know, this fella drank 6 bottles of port a day, he fed his dog steak and champagne. He went duck shooting naked on a frozen lake. He dressed up as a highwayman and ambushed his guests. He rode a bear into dinner when, you know, as a kind of a spectacle. But he was absolutely fine, so there was nothing kind of untoward about his behaviour, and he's buried in the crypt. So, you know, they didn't have to bury him under a big massive sandstone slab. But anyway, the church...
It's everyday sexism, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
But hold on, she'd been having sex with the devil. She hadn't been riding a bear. They're two very different
things. No, but she didn't actually have sex with the devil, Dominic. She was probably tortured. She died in prison probably because they tortured her.
I just think we should take a bit of a open-minded approach to these.
Okay, fine. Anyway, number 8 is Aon Hallow in Scotland. And so,
hold on, no, that wasn't even number 8.
No, but these were just kind of
leading. This is the preamble.
I like a preamble. Okay, very, very quickly. Aon Hallow is an island in Orkney, and it was once in the grip of a magic spell, and it was completely inaccessible to humans. So stories go that it was occupied by the Finn folk, who are kind of, you know, sorcerers, sort of dementory type people. And they used to abduct children and all that sort of stuff. But basically, humans eventually did make it over there, and by the salt and the sign of the cross, they retrieved the island from the Finn folk and they built a little church there. And for a long time it was thought that the soil of this Aon Hallow was so sacred that it would repel anything that was undesirable, so even rats and mice. So people used to like to go and get a handful of soil to kind of keep all the undesirables from their house. Anyway, really quickly, because I don't have very much time, this is a really kind of ancient old Norse church on Orkney. It's just a ruin now. The church was repurposed into a dwelling in and around the 16th century. Nobody knew it was there until it was discovered by chance in 1851. But it is hugely important, massively under-researched, you can see bits of the Norse kirk, the porch, the gables, the naves, the chancel walls. They're kind of all sorts of there.
And is it under research because it's so difficult to... Nobody can live there.
Is it under research because nobody... You can go out there one day a year.
One day a year?
Yeah.
So no wonder it's difficult to research.
Exactly. Anyway, very quickly, because we have no time. Moving on. So what I love about churches is all the stuff in them.
Is this number 9 now?
This is number 9. Yeah, very quick. Number 9. Okay. Whew. Big shout out to St. Botolph's, Hardham in West Sussex.
This is the preamble again.
This is the preamble. Okay. Big shout out to St. Botolph's, Hardham in West Sussex, which has some of the oldest wall paintings in the UK. It's got the Annunciation, the Massacre, Adam and Eve, George and the Infidels, Doom, Flight into Egypt. All there, amazing, date to about the 1100s, on the side of a road, cars flying past, nobody knows it's there. Great.
And it survived because it was whitewashed. Was it just so obscure?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
St. Lawrence, Broughton in Buckinghamshire. Brilliant church. On the outskirts of Milton Keynes. It's really great wall paintings. Nothing on the outside. Inside, 15th century wall paintings. Massive George and the Dragon. You've got Dooms. You've got, you know, blacksmiths. You've got all this sort of stuff. What I love is it's got a little panel called The Warning to the Blasphemers. And you've got all these kind of, you know, contemporary... dressed 15th century fellas and looking all nice and dandy, and in the middle is a Pieta, and Christ is kind of lying there and his body is kind of being pulled apart, so it's like the skin is shredded off his arms and legs and there's blood dripping around, and these guys are like, you know, they're drinking and they're playing, you know, I don't know, backgammon or something, and they're swearing on Christ's body, and basically and some of them hold up bits of bones and heart and stuff like that, and it's that every time you swear on Christ's body or you blaspheme, you're prolonging Christ's suffering. There we go. Anyway, the real star, number 9, is St. Cadoc's Llangharfan in Vale of Glamorgan. So these
Not St. Thomas's in Salisbury.
No, it's not. This is a better one, Tom. Sorry. Much better, actually, because the Salisbury one is lovely, but actually it's been really over-restored. Sorry about that. Please don't kill me or hate me. Anyway, this is a great church.
Fair enough.
A little whitewashed church in the Vale of Glamorgan. The wall paintings were only discovered in 2008. And they are they're some of the best in the whole of Europe. Unbelievably beautiful. So you've got a huge George and the Dragon. You've got the Virgin Mary blessing him. You've got the princess. You've got the people in the tower. But what's really cool is it's got the seven deadly sins and the seven acts of mercy. And the seven
Have you
seen it? Oh, good. Hooray.
I have. Yes. And it is better than St. Thomas's in Salisbury.
Yes, okay.
No, you're right.
Brilliant, thank you.
I mean, of course you're right, but no, thanks.
Oh, I'm really glad. Phew. Okay, because I only have about 1 minute to do the last one, but just very quickly.
No, Rachel, you don't. Just take your time.
Okay.
Because this is quality. This is quality, so it's fine.
All right, okay. Well, just really quickly. Okay, so this church is brilliant. I said about the St. George and the Dragon. It's also got a Death and the Gallant, which is completely unique. So you've got kind of, you know, a nice, again, kind of a nice contemporary dandy fellow, and then a skeleton and a shroud kind of like looking over him. Seven Deadly Sins, they are in brilliant condition. And what I love about them is there's like a central beast and it's got multi heads, and the heads kind of come up, and in the jaws of each of the kind of sub heads of this beast, there's a little panel that contains the each each of the seven deadly sins. And it's just, they are so I mean, they're just amazing. So in each one of my favorite ones is Gluttony, which is there's a man and he's kind of got a big swollen stomach, and his buttons are popping off his vest, and there are kind of empty glasses all around him, and there's a little demon who's pulling back his head and forcing more beer down his neck, kind of forcing him to drink more, and they're just so brilliant, and just to say they were discovered completely by chance. And they were getting some work done to the wall plate. They were doing a little bit of timber repair. And the builder saw a bit of red paint and said, oh, that might be interesting. Completely by chance. And really, yeah, some of the best in Europe. So wow. There we go. Dominic, you should go there. Okay, last one. Now I'm really worried that we're going to end on a low point, because I've kind of just raced through and I've kind of just kept something really quick for last. But anyway, this is Literary Connections. So, you know, loads of Literary Connections. Thomas Hardy, you know, love of my life, all of that sort of stuff. This one is Saint Michael and All Angels in Hathersage, which is, do you know it, Tom? Making
no.
a noise? No,
don't think so.
Okay, so this isn't a Hardy church, but it's basically a 14th century church. Lots of all interesting things, but the big thing here is the heirs. They're absolutely everywhere in the church. They were the lords of the manor for about 800 years, so you can see them on, you know, the font, the porch, the memorials on the walls, coats of arms.
The heirs,
everywhere.
Sorry, that's their surname.
Heirs, yeah, sorry, heirs.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, E-Y-R-E-S.
Yeah.
Basically, in 1854, Charlotte Bronte came here. She attended services with her friend, who was Ellen Lucy, who was the sister of the newly appointed vicar. And she, basically Charlotte Bronte, took loads from this church and her kind of time in Hathersage to write Jane Eyre, which is great. So the village of Hathersage becomes the village Morton. Henry Newsey, who's the vicar, becomes St. John Rivers, who, you know, saves Jane or whatever. And Jane Eyre is obviously named after the heirs, which is great. And then very finally, in the churchyard, apparently is... that is also apparently the resting place of Robin Hood's great friend Little John.
Little John. Very good. Oh.
Because in 1784, Captain James Shuttleworth discovered a massive femur, a massive thigh bone that was over a metre long.
Oh, it must have been him.
Must have been him. So basically, the person the bone was attached to would have been over 8 feet tall.
And there's only one person in all history. That
yep.
could be.
Exactly.
Why did they think it was Little John?
They probably just wanted like tourism or something, you know.
Okay.
Even in the 1784, yeah. No, I think I think there's a legend that his Little John's like hat and coat used to hang his hat and coat in the church and stuff like that.
Oh,
you
I
know?
See.
But you know, so
oh, I see.
He was kind of they kind of knew he was around there, so they just said.
So that was your number 10, Rach.
Whew. Yeah.
And you didn't choose any churches from your native country.
Well, I didn't because when you said it to me, first of all, you didn't include Ireland. And actually, you gave me the wrong date. You gave me the 13th of August for this. So I had been working to a different date, so the list was kind of ready for a long time. So anyway, so I was working to that. And then, Tom, I nearly died when you said Britain and Ireland. That was panic.
Well,
I mean,
huge apologies to our Irish listeners and to you, Rachel.
Sorry.
For Dominic's incompetence.
What?
I mean... I can choose one very quickly, but it's
yes. Let's have an Irish.
Basically,
one.
An Irish one. I will. It's an obvious choice for me, but it's my local church. We grew up in Turner's Cross, which is a 1920s suburb of Cork City in Ireland. The church there is amazing. It was built in about 1920. Started building in about 1929, I think. But it is the first concrete church in the whole of Ireland. But also some people say it's the first modernist church in Ireland. But it was designed by a guy called Barry Byrne, who was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright. He was based in Chicago. He never even got to see the church. But it's just amazing. What I love about it is it kind of takes... it draws on like Christ the Redeemer, so it's a massive Christ with open arms, and you kind of walk under the doors under his arms, and it's, you know, limestone on the outside, limestone sculpture, really interesting kind of, yeah, the way the trusses are arranged internally, so it's you know, beautifully lit, kind of a stepped gable, all this sort of stuff, lovely like black marble and well, all this sort of stuff. Anyway, well,
let's put that in as 11th, and you know, I think we really need to find a way to put this list somewhere, don't we?
We should put images on online, Tom, shouldn't we?
We'll put the image, and yes, and when we publicise this on Twitter, we'll add. So, Rich, if you send us the list, that would be great, because I mean, that's a fantastic array you've given us. I can't thank you enough.
And Rach, you should plug your charity.
Okay.
So you're the director of Britain's leading churches charity. Other church charities are available, but they're not as good, let's be honest.
No, this
yours is the Friends of Friendless Churches. So tell us just a tiny bit about this extraordinary named organization.
Okay, fine. So the Friends of Friendless Churches, we were founded in 1957, and it was basically, it was the 13th of July, churches were being demolished, being declared redundant and just being left fall apart. And this Welshman, who was our main founder, Ivor Bulmer Thomas, gathered a group of all his friends. Tom, you spoke about T.S. Eliot. T.S. Eliot was one of the founders. John Betjeman, John Piper, Lady Mander from Whittock, Roy Jenkins, all of these people got together and they called themselves the Friends of Friendless Churches. And they would be the group that goes out and defends these buildings that when they are no longer used for worship. And that's basically what we do. You know, churches are closing. More churches are probably going to close, but they are some of the greatest buildings. They are the spiritual investment of generations. They're like, I mean, they are, regardless, I think they kind of transcend time and race and religion, and that they are just saturated with kind of human experience. They also contain some of the best art and architecture. They're everywhere, and that they should be protected for everybody and not sold off to private individuals. And that's what we do. We work in England and Wales. We're non-denominational. We currently have 60 churches in our care, and we take on more every single year. And we do it with a grant of £120,000. So we on a shoestring. So yeah.
Okay. Well, I can't thank you enough for that. And I think that your selection,
brilliant,
eminently proves what you said about churches. Okay. I mean, they're kind of incredible fascination.
Well, I guess
thanks so much.
Sorry. I guess what I wanted to... Sorry, Tom. I guess
she's
what
still
I,
going.
Well, no, I guess the reason why I kind of chose these ones is that you don't need to go to kind of... Even the smallest and most obscure church, the one on the side of a motorway, is still packed with history, even if it's, you know, Saxon, inventor of the torpedo, Von Trapps, it's all there. You know.
Okay, thank you very much, Rach.
Thank you
to everybody for listening. Visit your local church, donate to the Friends of Friendless Churches, and most of all, listen to the next Rest is History. We'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.